Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Sunday Shakeout. I'm your host, Nicholas, and in today's episode, I share a fantastic conversation with Phil Batterson. Phil is a competitive runner, a former running coach, and founder of Critical Oxygen. Phil has a PhD in human bioenergetics and a love for the sport of running. His goal with Critical Oxygen is to teach athletes how to optimize their physiology for maximum performance. You can find him on Instagram at Critical02 to check out some of his fantastic content that he makes to make science and physiology accessible to us normal mere mortals, or, you know, just normal competitive runners. In today's episode, Phil and I discuss his background and passion for the sport, how we can understand and adapt different training intensity zones into our running, his thoughts on the Norwegian training method, and more. Before we get into today's episode, if you haven't already and you are enjoying the Sunday Shakeout, please consider giving this podcast a follow and 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. That goes a long way in supporting the growth of the Sunday Shakeout so that I can keep having discussions with amazing people in the sport of running and, you know, just keep this deal going. Also, if you have any questions or would like to connect, feel free to reach out to me via Instagram at the Sunday Shakeout. Now, back to the show. Phil and I had an incredible conversation today. I barely edited the audio at all because I think that purely our conversation was a masterpiece by itself. So let's just get into it. Without further delay, please enjoy my conversation with Phil Batterson. Phil Batterson, welcome to the Sunday Shakeout. It's great to have you on the show today. I'm looking forward to today's conversation. First question, just, you know, what does a typical Sunday look like for you right now?
Yeah, Nicholas, thanks for having me. I was telling you offline that I'm just so encouraged by the fact that, you know, you're starting this podcast out when you're, you know, so young. And young doesn't mean inexperienced. And I listened to, you know, some of your episodes before this just to get an idea of what the podcast is going to be like. And I must say, I'm very impressed with what you're doing. So keep up the good work. Sundays for me, though, I have 4 dogs and a loving fiance, and we just like to get out and do something. So today, for example, my fiance is going and she's riding horses. I took our 4 dogs and we live right on the edge of a canyon. So we have about a mile down to a river and then a mile back up. So I took them, well, it was about 2.5 miles, but I took them down to the river. They played a little bit. I was wearing my weight vest. I walked down, walked back up, and now I'm here talking to you.
That's great. Where are you living right now?
So I'm in the Bend, Oregon area.
Oh, that's really nice. Really nice. Yeah. So weighted vest, is that kind of like your training for the day, or do you have something else on tap?
Yeah. So I've been battling. So something that you'll learn as you get older is that you're not as physically infallible as you once thought. You know, I'm sure as like a freshman in high school, you're like, okay, you know, I'm building volume. Have you had to deal with any injuries or anything before?
I've had to deal with this one like knee injury. I think it's related to growing. It's called like Osgood Schlatter's or something like that.
Yep.
But that's about it. Maybe like some minor calf stuff, but no, nothing serious at all.
Yeah. So I'm sure every, you know, older person that you ever talk to is going to be like, oh, well, when you get older, you're going to get injured. but yeah, so I've been battling. I have an issue with my hip. It's called a torn labrum. So it's the cartilage that's around your hip that actually keeps your femur inside. It's got a little tear in it, and that kind of messes up my lower back and then my hip and stuff. So I've been battling that, and I got to be kind of careful with it. And what I found is that doing the weighted hiking and rucking and that sort of stuff actually doesn't exacerbate it. So it's one of those things where, you know, that's kind of where I have to be right now. And then I do a lot of just like easy walking, maybe some easy jogging, but I'm not doing as much performance related stuff as I once was.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah, that's kind of crazy to think about. Hopefully that, I can delay those years as long as possible, and I could just keep stacking on that volume. That would be great.
Yeah.
Now, I was going down a rabbit hole with some of your Instagram content, and one of your quotes or key philosophies that I came across was, "What's practical becomes optimal." Can you elaborate on what that means for runners and how we should be structuring and executing our training based off of that?
Yeah. So when you're in high school and stuff, your training plan is generally kind of dictated to you, right? You go to school, you might run in the morning, if you're doing two-a-days, but generally your practice is in the afternoon. Your coach tells you what your practice is, those sort of things. But when you graduate and you don't have that organized time for practice, other things get in the way. Life stresses get in the way, work stresses get in the way. And this term, practical becomes optimal, actually came up on my podcast with this nutritionist. Her name is Lexi Kelson. She works for Performance Hydration and Nutrition. And she said this because she's worked with a lot of people who are trying to figure out, oh, how much carbohydrate am I supposed to take? Other things like that. And what she has found is that you need to do stuff that fits into your schedule and your lifestyle, because if you're able to do that, you're going to be able to maintain consistency with whatever it is you're doing, whether it's practicing your carbohydrate intake, training, other things like that. So you could have the most optimal training plan given to you, but if you have to do like two-a-days and you don't have time to do two-a-days, then it doesn't matter if that plan is perfect. If you can't do it, it's not optimal. So you need to do something that is practical for you. And that, in most cases, especially as you get older and get, and maybe in college, right, if you're practicing, with a team with organized stuff, you still have that organized practice time. But again, is once you start to get out of that and make that transition, that's where this term practical becomes optimal really starts to shine, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah, I totally agree. Because obviously we're not full-time pro runners. We don't have the time to do a 2-hour session, then go home, eat, take a nap, then go to the gym for a lift session later on the day, and then, go for an evening double. We don't have time for that. And I think my cross-country coach, when I had him on the podcast, he talked about a similar thing. You know, if you have an athlete who checks all the boxes, he's checking the lactates, he's checking the heart rates, he's doing all these things, and you put him on the starting line against a guy who has had solid training, but he's really confident, the confident guy is always going to win. And so I think that it just comes down to that. Now, before we get into the physiology side of things, mm-hmm. and I probably, by the way, will have to pull myself back because I have a lot of questions. But before we get into that, can we just get into your background in the sport? I mean, mm-hmm. I realize that you are a coach and a physiologist, and you're also quite an accomplished runner. So can we just get into your story and how you got into this field?
Yeah, yeah. So I was a team sport athlete up until about, seventh grade. And then I kind of realized that I was like the in-betweener. Like, I wasn't big enough to be like a big man on the basketball court, but I was too slow to be a point guard, for example. And that kind of fit for pretty much every sport, no matter what you look at, football, baseball, basketball. My eighth grade year, I wrestled for half a year because one of my buddies was on the team, and I wasn't particularly good at wrestling, but what I did love was the running around the high school, or like the middle school, with my headphones in, listening to the first album, or maybe the second album that Fall Out Boy had dropped. And I just felt like I was running super fast because all the lockers are whizzing by you and all of that. So that kind of got me interested in, running track and doing other things like that. And I came out of that season actually really fit. And so I went into track season, and I actually set the junior high record in the mile and the 2 mile. And they weren't very fast, but they were still the record. So I was like, oh, dude, maybe I can run. Maybe this whole running thing is a thing for me. So, that kind of cemented my love for cross country and track. And then I just struggled with injuries and not staying consistent throughout my high school career. And up until the transition between my junior and my senior year, I hadn't been consistent for like summer running, just because my high school didn't really have a good summer running program. We didn't really have many people that wanted to like meet up and run and do those sort of things. But I finally took it upon myself. I was like, look, I'm going to get the most out of my senior year. So I'm going to go run with my buddy, who ended up being like a 4:10 miler in high school. So he was pretty fast. His coach was nice enough to, not get mad at me when I just showed up to their high school practices pretty much all summer. And I ended up running, I think, around 400 to 500 miles that summer leading into my senior year. Yeah. Wow. So it was a lot. It was a lot. I spent so much time with my buddy. I was like, we'd like spend the night like 3 days a week. And then we just go running in the morning and running at night. And that's all we did. And then in the middle, we would play. Yeah. And then we would play video games. So it was a great summer. And I finally realized some level of potential. I ended up running, I think, like a 16:22 or something like that in terms of my 5K. And, you know, that kind of showed, I was like, oh man, well, what if I would have been a little bit more consistent? What if I would have had a little bit better of a coaching staff? What if, you know, all these what ifs kind of started popping into my brain. And at the same time, I did realize the importance of a good coach. So I always told myself, and I've always asked the question, why? It's like, why are we doing this sort of workout? Why are we doing that sort of workout? Sure. I'm sure you kind of have the same questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and you know, if an authority figure didn't have a good answer for me, then that kind of, made me lose my confidence in them. Because if you don't have a good reason to do something and it's just because I said so, or because this is what I've always done, then, you know, that doesn't prove to me that you actually were thinking at a little bit higher level about this sort of stuff and organizing it better. So, long story short, did a little bit of, I was on the rowing team my freshman year of college, transitioned over to triathlon, had some fun with that, but I was studying mechanical engineering the entire time. Got a degree in mechanical engineering, went off to Georgia for my first job and did not like it. So started to explore, what do I really want to do with my life? And I wound up being the assistant coach at a high school down in Georgia called Marietta High. And Marietta had won, I think now they've probably won like 10 state championships in the last like 10 years or something like that. It's essentially like the guys win, then the girls win, then the guys win, then the girls win. And it's just like, it's absolutely incredible. And Jack Coleman is probably one of the best coaches I've ever like actually worked under. And we were fortunate enough. He had 5 guys on the team who were under 16 minutes in the 5K with another guy who was like 16:30. And they qualified for the Nike National race out here in Oregon. So through coaching there, I technically coached a national qualifying team. And that really got me like kind of like amped, you know, to, I was like, oh man, this is a great team. This is a great environment. So I was like, I need to go back to school though and get a master's degree if I want to try to be a, you know, like a college coach. Cause I didn't really see a high school coach being the way for me. Cause I didn't want to choose like I didn't want to teach, you know, like high school classes and then coach. I wanted to be a coach and then teach, you know, sort of thing. So, so I went back, I got my master's degree and that was in applied physiology. And that's where I learned all of this, like, you know, physiology testing. So how to do VO2 max tests, how to do lactate tests. During that time I worked for the Olympic Training Center for a couple of weekends. And I was doing some physiology testing on like the, I think it was like the U18 mountain biking team. So to see kind of like the state of the art, you know, what they do for testing. And that really got me interested as well. Then pursuing a little bit more of like the why behind things, I got really interested in like molecular exercise physiology. So whenever on my Instagram, I talk about like, oh, mitochondrial adaptations or why oxygen is important. Like that all comes from that molecular side of things. So I did my PhD in that, but I realized that I like talking and thinking about the molecular side of things, but I like to teach and expose people to the applied side of things. So now what I do is I have a mobile physiology lab. So if an individual is interested, they'd call me up. They'd say, hey, Phil, I want to do some physiology testing. And I'd say, okay, let me get my truck. Let me drive down to your place and we'll do all this testing for you. So that's where I'm at now. And I obviously try to stay fit and, you know, use the principles that I preach, because I do think that, you know, exercise needs to be a lifelong thing, not only for performance, but from a wellness perspective as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. I once heard that guy, Jason Fitzgerald, he once said like running is a lifestyle or something like that. Uh-huh. It's not just something that you get to do like part-time. If you want to be good at running, like it's something that you have to commit your life to. Mm-hmm. And I also like, I can relate to this idea of wanting to know why, like what goes into this? Why does this work? And I just love your passion for the sport. I think that that's really, really just very interesting to me, just getting addicted to the process of improvement. looking for ways to get better and to learn more than just like surface level and getting your sleep and hitting your splits, but like learning about like what's going on inside your body and how you can optimize that. And so, yeah, that's what we're going to get into today and why that stuff's going on and how we can improve our running. So first I kind of want to talk a little bit about intensity, because I think that one common challenge that many runners face, especially those who are new to the sport, one common challenge they might face is understanding and managing their intensity during their runs. You know, maybe there's confusion about how to gauge their intensity, or lack of understanding for execution. But it's clear that, you know, intensity, it does play a pretty crucial role. So could you provide kind of like a framework for like dividing these like intensity zones up and kind of like help us to understand how we can navigate these different training zones physiologically?
Yeah. So I'll start with, I think, you know, like, have you heard the term polarized training?
Yeah.
It's a big buzzword around, but I think what at the heart of it, we have two ways that we can manage adaptations to our running. We can increase our volume or we can increase our intensity. The way that I view intensity is if your performance is like the Statue of David or something along those lines, high intensity work or higher intensity work is kind of like taking a sledgehammer to that big thing of marble and just taking huge chunks out. Like you're just breaking off chunks of that marble, and it's really easy to overdo it on that intensity, right? And then have fractures in your marble. So yeah, that'd be like an injury. That'd be like overtraining. So you need to do enough of that to start to get the general shape of what your marble should be, right? If you want it to be the Statue of David, it should look like a, you know, kind of resembling a human in a sense.
Yeah.
But then the lower intensity stuff, that zone two stuff, is where you get out your fine chisel and your fine hammer and you start to just, you know, just tink away. And the reason why I say that is because that lower intensity training is really good for increasing your volume. And I mean, there's countless studies out there that have looked at, oh, what's the differentiating factor between somebody who is really, really good and somebody who's only okay. And generally speaking, it's volume with intensity sprinkled in, because you have to have the intensity in order to, you know, get the large adaptations. So that's the first thing. That's the first thing I want us to think about. Then the next thing I want us to think about is, okay, well, how do we actually manage that? To some extent, we want our hard days to be hard and our easy days to be easy. A lot of the times what I see, especially with people who are trying to get what they think is the most out of their adaptations, is that they go too hard on their easy days, and then that keeps them tired and doesn't allow them to go hard enough on their hard days. So I saw this with, you know, tens, if not hundreds of athletes, where it was like, you know, you'd have somebody who would go out, they'd win the warm up, and then they'd win their zone two workout. And then they would just kind of, you know, have an off day every single time we'd get to the track where we do, you know, our high intensity stuff, our mile repeats, our 800s, our 400s, you know, up to maybe a 2K or something along those lines. And you'd be like, man, it's like, well, if running slow was the indicator of, you know, performance, then you should be winning all of the intervals too. But you're tiring yourself out by doing your slow stuff too fast. And then that doesn't allow you to do your fast stuff fast. So then everything kind of becomes monotone in a sense. So I like to use intensity as a way of saying, for your easy work, don't go above this pace, this heart rate. I think those are generally the easiest two. And then for your fast stuff, here's a range that you should be hitting based on your 5K times, based on your mile times, based on your 2 mile times. And the reason why I like to use pace during high intensity is because heart rate takes a while. If you've ever worn a heart rate monitor, heart rate actually takes a little bit to actually get up to the heart rate that you're supposed to be at. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you're dehydrated, you're tired. It takes a little bit for your heart rate actually to ramp up. So if you're always aiming for a heart rate in those intervals, you might walk away from those interval sessions and be like, well, I didn't hit the heart rate. So I am an objective failure, you know, sort of deal. As opposed to if you have like a target range of interval pace, say you're doing mile repeats and your range is between 5 minutes and 5:20. That's a big range, but if you can hit 5 minutes to 5:20, that's the goal. That's going to get you most of the way there. Whether you're a little bit faster, you know, like say 5:10 is really the goal and you run 5:05, that's okay. If you're 5:10 and you run 5:15, that's still okay. But if you can't hit those paces, then you obviously something's going on. So you need to go do more easy stuff. So what Jack Coleman would do during the high school training is if somebody wasn't hitting their pace, he'd just send them on a cool down and he'd just say, look, it's fine. Like today just wasn't the day to do the high intensity stuff. And I think that's another thing that like runners who are, you know, either in high school or in college, or even, you know, even the runners who are just starting into the interval stuff. If you can't hit your interval goals on a day, it doesn't mean you have to like work through it and dig yourself a deeper fatigue hole. You can delay that one day, recover, and then come back and then do it again. It doesn't matter if it's on a Wednesday or a Thursday. So that's kind of how I approach this. I would approach easy days with like heart rate zones and then harder days with speed. And if you do you want to go into how we actually determine what the heart rate is, what the speed is, other things like that?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to ask about next. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, it gets challenging because with an individual, I would, you know, like put them through a battery of physiological assessments. We would do like a VO2 max test. We would determine then their ventilatory threshold 1 or lactate threshold 1, their lactate threshold 2, ventilatory threshold 2. But if we don't have access to that, which I don't think a lot of people actually do have access to physiological testing, one of the best ways to figure this sort of stuff out is do a performance that is based on what you're going to be racing. So if it's a 5K, you could run a 2 mile, you could do, you know, a 5K, obviously. And then there's tools out there that will get you really close. So one of them is from a coach called Jack Daniels, who made the VDOT calculator. So I love that because it does give you a really, really good approximation based on your last performance, what you should be training and racing at. And it gives you delineations with your intervals and your speed. If you're trying to figure out heart rate, and this is actually something that I'm going to be posting relatively soon, I think one of the best ways to do it is you probably need to do three different tests. You're going to need to do a max heart rate test. So get on a treadmill and wear a heart rate monitor. Start at like an easy jog. Every minute, you're going to increase your intensity by, I think, between like 0.3 and 0.5 miles per hour per stage until basically you can't go any further. Obviously, don't do anything dangerous. Don't fall off the treadmill, those sort of things. But that's going to give you what your max heart rate is. You could stop there and you could say, okay, I have my max heart rate. And then typically, you know, like there's recommendations of, oh, well, zone one should be between this and this max percent of max heart rate. Zone two should be here, 3, 4, and 5. You can do that. I don't think it's the, it'll get you close, but it's not the optimal way to do things. The next thing you can do is you wear your heart rate monitor during what we would call like a zone two or a longer workout with the goal of making it so your heart rate does not drift more than 5% over the course of your 1 to 2 hour workout. So I'm not going to do the math right off. Let's just say, okay, so say, you know, we started at 100 beats per minute. That'd be really, really low for a lot of people. Then the goal for that would be not to get above 105, because that would be a 5% drift, right? So you can do this and you can iterate on it. So you can say, okay, well, week one, I went out and I started my run. And after the first 10 minutes, heart rate was 130. And then after, you know, the hour that I ran, it was 166. That's definitely above 5%, right? So the next time you say, okay, well, I ran that too hard. Don't beat yourself up about it. Just say the next time you come back, say, okay, well, now over the course of that hour, I'm going to try to get it up, you know, to whatever that 5% is. So you say 130 to whatever 5% of that is, 140-ish. So that would be the next way of like kind of dialing it in. And then you can run those easier runs, especially early in the season, by heart rate. And you can say, okay, well, I know that, you know, a heart rate of about 135-ish is what's going to be that speed that would then allow for less than 5% decrease or change in my speed output. So that would be the second one. And then you still need to figure out what your tempo pace is. So right. This would be, you'd go to a track and you'd do something, it's called like a critical speed test. So you would do, you'd warm up and then you'd do 30 minutes, 20 to 30 minutes around the track. And you would say, okay, it's best effort. And you would take the average of the last 15 to 20 minutes as your heart rate. And you would say, okay, now my tempo heart rate is about 165. So then you could actually go out and you could do like tempo work and you say, okay, well, I'm going to try to accumulate time at about 165 beats per minute. So that's a way of getting around having to go to, you know, like a laboratory and do the metabolic testing and all of that sort of stuff.
That's very interesting. I think I've done the critical speed test. I think I did a 30-minute time trial. The hardest thing for me was like I went out like too hard because I had never done a 30-minute like thing before. Like I've done some 5Ks and 10Ks, but I've never done a solo 30-minute test. So mm-hmm. I completely bombed that one. Maybe I'll try that again sometime. Now, for me, Phil, throughout the winter, I've been training for my track season. I used my heart rate to control my intensity, especially, you know, for my easy runs, long runs, and tempos. But I noticed that as the winter progressed, my zones started to change a lot. You know, I had like a rough cross country season. And so at the beginning of winter, I was kind of out of shape. I was jogging along at like 9 minute pace at like 160 heart rate.
Okay.
But as the training progressed, my heart rate actually started to get a lot lower. But I was also getting like faster. So now I was able to run like 750 pace at like 155 beats per minute.
Mm-hmm.
But this creates a challenge because I'm no longer able to like confidently like say like, okay, where are my zones? Like I'm kind of confused on my runs. So what I'm getting at is as runners progress in our training, how should we like adapt our intensity zones to kind of reflect that improvement in fitness? Like, do we need a reevaluation or retesting, or how should we do that?
No, Nicholas, I think that's exactly what you should be doing. Is every, depending if it's the off season, I would say probably every 6 to maybe 10 weeks, depending on how long your off season is, you could retest and then reevaluate. But if we go back to, you know, using that, 5% drift as a determinant of what our zone two is, then that's like every single week, you know, you're probably doing something kind of like that. So you're almost getting like a testing scenario every single week. And then you would be able to say, okay, well, last week I ran my hour at 9 minute pace and 160 beats per minute. Then you come back the next week and it's like, okay, well now it's 155 and, you ran it even faster. So I would say that is, just a good indication that you're trending in the right direction because both your heart rate is going down and your speed is getting faster. It absolutely gets confusing because if you kept running at, if you kept running at 160, then you'd be, probably cooking. You'd be pretty quick, doing those runs. If you only ran at 9 minute pace, then maybe your heart rate would get super, super low. There's a combination of things that are going on, but I think like doing something that is going to allow you to do a field test or reevaluate as you go. And this is where good coaches come in because they'll be able to look at that and they'll be able to say, oh, well, Nicholas is improving. So we're just going to keep having him do what he's doing. And that's what really good coaches are there for, right? They're there to manage your intensity and manage your volume so you get to the season healthy and essentially with as big of a base as possible. Right now, I'm coaching one of the best female runners in Minnesota, and that's what we work on a lot is, okay, we're going to – how are you feeling? How are your knees? How are your ankles? Like any pain or anything like that? Okay, let's try to increase your volume a little bit more. And in the off season too, I don't do a terrible amount of intensity, because I mean, track season comes along, right? And you're going to be doing a workout, a long run, and a race, and maybe two races per week, right? So it's like, you're going to get plenty of intensity when that comes along. So I try to allow for more volume to be accumulated during the off season. And that's both winter and summer. And then have a little bit of that intensity. So like some tempo stuff, maybe a little bit of strides, you know, every other day, those sort of things, just because I like to keep the high intensity stuff kind of there, but it's not the focal point at all.
Right. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. It's more like, I like this, just the strategic approach overall. Sorry, my parents are coming in the door.
No problem.
But yeah, I just like this approach of like trying not to just focus on like the numbers and like the heart rates and all that, but also like the subjective, just like, how are you feeling and adjusting the training from there? Because, you know, we're humans and not everything is going to be absolutely perfect. Mm-hmm. So that does make a lot of sense. Now, if you've, you know, I'm sure most of the people in my audience have probably done some stuff on the internet in terms of like what's trendy in distance running.
Yeah.
And I think that lactate threshold intensity has kind of been all of the rave right now.
Mm-hmm.
The Ingebrigtsens have obviously blown it up with their double threshold training. One YouTuber even called it like the second lactate threshold, like the holy grail of training intensities.
Yeah.
So I think that the online narrative can be a little bit overwhelming for the average runner to kind of like synthesize like the information. So can you kind of just share your insights on like what they're doing, the Ingebrigtsens, and maybe, I guess, how we can apply that to our own training based off of your knowledge?
Yeah. Yeah. So if people haven't heard of this, you know, the Norwegian method of training is kind of become very popular. And what the Ingebrigtsens have done is, or at least this is a very, very small proportion of what they actually do in terms of all of their training, but they do lactate threshold training where they measure blood lactate. So it requires you to poke a hole in your finger, get a drop of blood, measure that with a lactate meter, and then see how much lactate is in your blood at any given time. And what they, or at least what's been reported that they do, is they measure a certain amount. So I think it's like 2.5 is like what they're aiming for. And that's like for their longer sessions. And then for their shorter sessions, it's like 3.5, something along those lines. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to accumulate as much speed work as they possibly can at or above their race pace without internally stressing their body too much. Because that's what we're trying to do by measuring lactate, is measure the internal stress. What is going on in our body in response to the speed that we're running at? So to answer your question, how can we take this and use it for our training? First of all, unless you're doing 80 to 100 miles a week and you actually use a lactate meter like every single day and know what your numbers are, I wouldn't recommend this to 99.9% of people. You got to remember that like Jakob Ingebrigtsen is probably one of the best contemporary middle distance runners of our time. He's incredible, and he's trying to milk like 0.01% increases in his time so he can be the world champion in the 3K, the world champion in the 1500, the world champion in the 5K, those sort of things, right? So, and then immediately what we talked about earlier, right, is he has the time throughout the day. He can go and he can do his morning, you know, interval session. He can go and just lay around, eat some food, chill, and then he can go and do another hard session. If you're in high school, if you're in college, whatever it is, we don't have that luxury. If you have a job, right? Like you're going to work and you're going to be stressed all day. Like I don't know anybody who has just like, yes, they might be sitting down, but it's still mentally stressful, and stress is stress. So I would say I would not have that be your goal, is to do double threshold days. I think it's just too much of that sledgehammer. Like we were talking about, you're going to wind up with cracks in your statue. So that's the first thing. But where I do think that second threshold training is valuable, and this could be, this is, again, this is what we measured from that FT or that critical speed test, is how fast or how high our heart rate should be. So you can go and you can go do tempo work, right? You can do, you know, your 8 minutes on, 2 minutes off. You can do 20 minutes on, 4 minutes off by two. You can do all of these different things to get your body to be working at that second threshold for extended periods of time. And the reason why it's so effective at helping a lot of high school, college, shorter distance, like, so I would say anything under a 10K, is because it's very sport specific to what you're going to be racing. It's a 10K is you know, for fast, super fast people, about, you know, 30 minutes. And, you know, so that by definition is pretty much what your critical speed is. So 10K, you know, so 30 minutes and kind of lower, that's why it's so beneficial to a lot of people, is because it is very, very specific to what you're going to be racing. And in order to get good at racing what you're going to be racing, you have to do specific exercise at that intensity.
Yeah. Yeah. So you said two things that I think were really key. Number one, you said how they're trying to just get marginal gains from their training. They already have pretty much everything optimized. They have their sleep, their nutrition, all of their other training. They do not have like any external stressors in their life. So in order to get better, they can't make these huge changes. It's just literally like small, super small increments. And so the lactate tests need to happen in order to make those increments. Mm-hmm. Whereas us, you know, we don't have everything dialed in. We don't have the time to get everything dialed in. So just by mm-hmm. getting in the solid training and focusing on the fundamentals, that is going to work for us.
Yeah.
And then the second thing, what was the second thing you were talking about? Oh yeah. The specificity. Yeah. Cause don't the Ingebrigtsens, they do like, shorter intervals because they're able to make the intervals faster. And faster makes it more specific.
Yes.
Right. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah. Because if you think about it right there, you know, 1500 3K is super fast, right? You know, sub 4 minute miles potentially. So like, so in order to accumulate more volume at the intensity that is going to be specific to their racing, they want to be running faster. But again, they want to maintain that internal stress and make sure it doesn't go too high, because that's again where you can really run the risk of injury, burnout, other things like that. And another thing that you kind of brought up is people who haven't been training very long stand to gain the most from pretty much doing anything. So you don't have to go in and be like so specific. It's like, if you just run more, you're probably going to get better. That's what happened to me during my senior summer. I had never run that much in my life, but it's one of those things where, you know, four or 500 miles, no matter how fast they are, I PR'd by like a minute or something like that. So it was in that we didn't do any speed work or anything like that all summer. All we did was just run a lot. So that's, again, part of my point is, if you've never done that sort of stuff, if you've never built your volume up, generally volume is a little bit easier to cope with, because again, it's, there's small adaptations that happen over time, and you don't run as much of a risk of overdoing it as you do high intensity.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. I think that volume is key, and like, there needs to be a general trend in your running journey from more like simple to more complex training, but it needs mm-hmm. to be slow and gradual. You can't jump into complex training right off the bat. Mm-hmm. Now, let's say there's a runner, more of a beginner runner, but they've kind of built up their volume a little bit, and they want to start incorporating some high intensity work because they mm-hmm. feel like they're up to like a volume where it's safe for them to do that sort of thing. Maybe it's VO2 max work or threshold work. What would be your advice for just getting into it? Like, would you have them do some cross training intervals necessarily, or how would you kind of like plan that out so they could like safely progress so that they can get the physiological adaptations without overdoing it? Because obviously, mm-hmm. like you said, just doing a little bit of the new thing will get you a long way. So how mm-hmm. are you going to kind of plan that out?
Yeah, I really like the idea of, you know, potentially doing some cross training on like a bike or something like that. We know it's not going to be 100% crossover in terms of the benefits that you would actually get, but cycling compared to running is like not weight bearing at all. So the amount of damage that you're going to be incurring is fairly little, and you'll be able to gain the benefits, the physiological benefits of that high intensity stuff. So you can be a little bit more liberal with your application of high intensity stuff if you're doing it on a bike or maybe an elliptical, something along those lines. But most people, we like to run fast. We like to run fast around a track, right? You know, it's just fun. So I would say, like, I would never start somebody doing like mile repeats. Like, I don't think that's appropriate. That's a lot of volume in terms of the intensity. But I would say, you know, you could do something where you're doing like 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off. And, you know, you could start even with just like 10 of those. So that'd only be 5 minutes of accumulated time. You're just getting your body used to it. You have a coach who's just blowing the whistle every 30 seconds, and then you're going hard, and then you're kind of either jogging or walking, and then you're going hard, and then you're jogging or walking. You don't need to know a pace. You don't need to know anything like that. And you'll know very quickly if you went out way, way, way too hard, because by that 10th interval, you're not going to be able to go fast. I imagine kind of what happened with your critical speed test, right? Where it's like,
Oh yeah,
I'm super excited about this. Maybe I've never paced my 30-minute test before. I went out way too hard, and now I'm basically just like limping across the finish line, you know, gasping for air. So I would always start with, you know, just slow implementation of, you know, 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off, maybe 1 minute on, 1 minute off, build up from there. That's especially on the VO2 max side of things. Tempo kind of similar. You could probably do like 4 minutes on, 2 minutes off. And that would be something that could potentially help. It should be done much slower than your VO2 max or your your VO2 max speed. It should be something that is like, okay, I could maintain this for an extended period of time, and the first 4 minutes are going to feel super simple. And then you're going to rest, and you're going to be like, wow, I feel great. And then you're going to do another 4 minutes. It's still going to feel pretty easy, but might be getting a little bit harder. Then you're going to rest 2 minutes. And then you could do three. You could do, you know, 4 minutes by three, 2 minutes rest. And again, because you've never done this before, because you've never done interval training before, you're still going to get gains, the newbie gains, as we would call it in the strength training community, to very minimal amounts of volume being, placed upon you. So keep that in mind. Here's another thing that I always try to do is, we should aim for the minimum amount of work that's going to elicit the most amount of benefit or change. So if you like looked at a graph in terms of, and this goes back to like the Ingebrigtsens and, you know, they're trying to, they have to do, that is their minimal amount of work that they have to do to get change now. But for most of us, the amount of, you know, benefit to time invested is going to look something, if you can actually see that, it's going to look something like this, where it's a very steep curve in the beginning and then it flattens out. So it's really important to know, or to get a sense of when you go from the steep portion of that curve to the flat portion of that curve. And I almost always stay on the conservative side of things, because I've found that I would rather have somebody stay healthy and have consistency for, say, 2 to 4 years, then be like, oh, well, we just crushed this workout. We did 5 mile repeats and whatever it was. And then 2 weeks later, they're sick or injured, you know, and then they're out for, you know, 3 weeks or 6 weeks. Well, you just lost 6 weeks of training. So you could have been going like this, but instead you're doing nothing, most likely. So you're actually, you have like a reverse curve where it's like steep losses and then followed by, you know, a little bit more flat, because when you stop doing things, the way your body reverts is quite fascinating in terms of how fast it actually does start to diminish your physiological adaptations.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I never thought of it like that way with like the diminishing returns graph. I had always thought of it, just like learning about it in class and school, but applying it to running like adds a whole new dimension. Kind of reminds me of like that 80-20 like Pareto principle, where like 20% of the inputs create like 80% of the outputs, and so you don't need a ton of stuff. It can be simple. But yeah, Phil, thank you so much for coming on the Sunday Shakeout today. It's been a pleasure to have you on. You're always welcome back on. And yeah, thanks for all the science you bring to the running world. And I hope that my listeners enjoy.
Nicholas, thanks for having me on. If your listeners have any questions or anything, reach out to me on Instagram at CriticalO2. That's literally what my mission statement is to help people optimize their physiology to maximize their endurance potential. So any questions you have, DM me. I always do like Q&As and stuff like that. So find on my stories and just enter in those Q&As, and I'd be more than happy to help you out.
I love it, Phil. Have a great day. Thank you.
Awesome. You too. Thanks, Nicholas.
Thanks for listening to episode 69 of the Sunday Shakeout with Phil Batterson. Our conversation today was a lot of fun, and if you liked today's conversation, feel free to leave a follow and 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. That goes a long way in supporting the growth of the Sunday Shakeout so that I can keep pushing out these great episodes for y'all. Yeah, if you have any questions or would like to connect, feel free to reach out to me at thesundayshakeout@gmail.com, and I'll get back to you as soon as possible, like faster than Usain Bolt, for real, believe me. You know, Paris is this summer, you never know, maybe I'll make the Olympics. Nah, just kidding. But I hope you all really enjoy the rest of your Sunday, and yeah, peace out. This is the Sunday Shakeout.